Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
I bet you thought the closing bell today would never come, huh? We will review the week that was from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 28th of February today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, there are weeks when I kind of have to set things up on a Friday afternoon, prep you for the conversation to come. This is not one of those weeks. Neil Richardson is at Raymond James. David Gura is at MSNBC. They are in our booth in New York, I think, right? Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Am I right? New York, yes?
We're here.
All right,
yes,
good.
But it's Edward Jones.
Yes, that's right. Edward Jones. I apologize. Not Raymond James.
No worries.
So look, actually, Neela, I'm glad you piped up first because I'm going to go to you. We have gotten the band back together again from 5 weeks ago when I posed a question that was along the lines of, do you think coronavirus could turn into a black swan that turns things, if not completely south, then maybe sideways? And you said, all other things being equal, probably not. Would you like to revisit that?
No.
Wow, really?
but I actually, I do not at this time think it's a black swan event. I think it's more of a black hole event. And we don't know the time or the breadth of that hole, but there's still so much uncertainty. I still stand by the fact that we have pretty healthy economic fundamentals so far. Yep. We've seen other situations over this 11th year expansion where there's been a quarterly decline, which I think we can expect a slowing growth because of the virus in the U.S. economy in the first quarter. That doesn't mean a derailment of the bull market or the economic expansion. It just means that the economy has hit a soft spot. So bottom line, it's too soon to tell.
Still too soon. Okay. Okay. All right. Fine. Fair enough. David, you took the other side of that bet.
I was the proud pessimist.
You were the proud pessimist. And look, I look. So let's be clear. I sided with Neela last time, so I was wrong too. Are you surprised, David Gura, by the speed with which things have gone south? It's been a week, and all of a sudden we're like, oh my goodness, you know.
I am. I was going to make a joke that you've worn out the Sad Trombone album, but the fact of the matter is we're in the money like a week ago. Yeah. Like 10 days ago, we were at records. So I think how quickly and how precipitously the market's fallen is what's given a lot of people pause here. So they're trying to figure out what's happened. But, you know, as Neil is saying, I think there's so much uncertainty about things beyond the economics of this. And that's what I think is driving investors crazy. Fundamentally, this comes down to science and medicine. We don't have good tests for this. We don't have a vaccine for this yet, of course. And you couple that with the communication strategy, if you can call it that, from the administration, it has been dissonant, to say the least. And I think investors are trying to get a handle on how big this is going to be, how bad this is going to be, and there just isn't a whole lot of clarity on that yet.
Yeah. Neela, I was writing yesterday's show, and I was trying to turn a phrase, and I wanted to say something like, you know, the economic fundamentals of what we're dealing with here, the fundamentals are still strong. And they are right now, as you said a minute ago. At some point, though, the actual economy, not just the market, will be affected. Yes?
Maybe.
Wow.
And again,
okay.
Too soon to tell. Look, there is some global impact that we will for sure see, and it's going to be a bigger impact in China who that is dealing with massive travel restrictions, quarantines of millions of people, shut down businesses. But there is some good news coming out of China, and that is that China is starting to open back for business and the case. And the reports of new cases of slowing. What's really changed for markets this week is that the impact has reached beyond China's borders.
Yep.
And that's the scary thing. We don't know how quickly this virus will spread or whether there will be a community-wide event in a developed market like the United States, which shuts down a city or a region for an extended period of time. That's what the markets are reacting to. And yes, that would have an economic effect, but there's a range of scenarios between the worst case and the best case, and any possibility can happen at this point.
Yep, totally fair. David, a note here about 2008-2009. I'm getting questions, you probably are, about whether this is 2008 all over again. And it has to be pointed out that the markets are functioning, right? There are buyers and sellers, credit exists, liquidity is there.
Yeah, it's functioning. And, you know, there were huge problems with the economy back in 2008-2009. To Neil's point, we don't have those same problems today. So that's something that's decidedly different here. And you look at the market today, a lot of the losses were erased. I mean, the market was way down at many points of the day. Today came back up here at the end. So yes, to some extent, there are buying opportunities here. But you look at places like the bond market, the 10-year U.S. bond is incredibly low at this point now, indicating the fact that people are flocking to safety. They want to find something amidst all of this. And at the same time, they're also having some faith here that the Fed is going to do something. And today you got this statement from the Fed chairman saying essentially the economy is doing fine. We're going to continue to monitor this. This is an evolving threat, I think he said. So you saw him trying to do what he could in three sentences or four sentences to give investors a bit of confidence.
I wonder if he thought about playing my game. What does Jay Powell think? We should call him and see what he says. That'd be pretty good. That'd be a little meta. Okay, so look, Neela, actually, just I was going to mention Jay Powell. He came out, made this. It has to be said, and it's an extraordinary statement for the Fed to come out of nowhere and have the Fed chairman say, listen, everything is fine. The market, however, while rallying into the close, I don't think much cared what the Fed chair had to say, because in all honesty, the Federal Reserve cannot create a vaccine.
No, it can't. And when all you have is a hammer, every problem is a nail. And we've learned that an interest rate cut can't solve trade tensions, and it can't immunize the population or the markets from the coronavirus. But what the Fed can do is show that there's someone paying attention that can stimulate credit markets, liquidity, keep liquidity flowing, and keep put a bottom in terms of the stock price, stock market decline. And that's exactly what Powell intended to do with the statement.
Neela Richardson at Edward Jones. I apologize for messing it up on the intro there, Neela. Won't happen again. David Gura, you can catch him on the TV, MSNBC, on Saturday and Sunday afternoons. David, yes,
there
right. Let's get the plug. There we go. All right. Thanks, you two. Have a
Thank
nice
you.
Weekend.
Take care.
See you later. It would take a veritable orchestra of wah-wah trombones to do justice to this week on Wall Street. We will try when we do the numbers. All right, so David was talking about bond yields there for a minute. He was talking specifically about the 10-year Treasury. It is the benchmark, and it hit its lowest level ever today in its yield, a touch over 1.1%. That means the government can borrow $100, do whatever it wants with that $100 for a decade, and then at the end of it, pay you back just $101 and change. That is basically nothing. It's free money, right? We pay attention to bond yields because they can tell us a whole lot about where the economy is going and where investors' heads are at. Interesting to know in these times, yes? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore takes it from there.
Yield just means how much money you're going to make on a bond. Very simply, if bond yields are falling, it means investors are paying more and more money to purchase bonds with smaller and smaller payoffs.
Crazy lows. I've never seen it this low. This is unprecedented.
Ken Kuttner is professor of economics at Williams College. So why would investors do this? Why put money in bonds with very little payoff? One reason is that the stock market is terrifying. Coronavirus has wiped out as much as $6 trillion of value from global markets.
When a lot of volatility in the stock market, investors were going to be pulling their money out of stocks. I have to put it somewhere.
U.S. Treasuries are just about the safest place you can put your money. Investors are saying, low payoffs be damned, the world out there is very unsafe for my money. Torsten Slok is chief economist at Deutsche Bank.
There's so much uncertainty about what will happen in the economy going forward.
He says all the regular numbers that might normally offer some reassurance, like the jobs numbers that'll come out next week, are not useful right now.
And even those indicators will not give us any information about how consumers and companies will and have reacted.
People are flying blind. Another reason why investors are okay with smaller and smaller yields on bonds is because they think low returns are going to be the norm for a while. Specifically, they believe interest rates are going to fall.
Right now, it looks like markets are expecting the Fed to cut interest rates by at least three times this year.
Seth Carpenter is chief economist at UBS.
Usually the market makes that kind of inference because they expect some sort of weakness, or at least risk of weakness, to the U.S. economy.
One thing that investors and everybody else needs right now is information, a better idea of just what the virus will or will not do to the global economy. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
One trickle down, if you'll pardon the mixing of the economic metaphors, of those low, low bond yields that Sabri was talking about, really cheap mortgages. The average rate on a 30-year fixed, says Freddie Mac, is now just 3.45%. That is a three-year low that could easily go even lower. And you would think that would be great for the real estate market, but all the uncertainty that is driving those rates lower, as Sabri was talking about, oh, it's on the minds of home buyers and business owners as well. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
Just this morning, real estate agent Joanne McCoy in Lincoln, Nebraska, got a text message from a client who had been looking to lease some space for a nail salon.
He's going to put that on hold for a while because of the coronavirus.
He didn't say exactly why, but McCoy says there's a lot of unease about COVID-19. Anyone who lost money in the stock market this week may have second thoughts about real estate.
They may be determining if this is the time to sit on the sidelines a little bit to see what happens with those investments.
Nitya Naranjan is a broker with Century 21 in Seattle, where he expects the market to slow as Chinese buyers pull back, but also Americans.
People, you know, don't make decisions when something like that happens. Should I buy a house? No. Maybe I should wait 6 months. Should I sell it? Maybe I should. So, you know, it's uncertainty creates problem in the economy.
It also creates opportunity, a chance for people who already have mortgages to get a better deal. According to data firm Black Knight, some 11 million homeowners could save money by refinancing. Broker Greg Goodrich outside Boise, Idaho, has seen business pick up, but not from home buyers.
The originations aren't really up. They're staying consistent, but they're not on fire like the refinances are.
Because one thing that hasn't changed, there aren't enough homes for sale at a price people can afford. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You may or may not, I guess, depending on your general level of cynicism, be shocked to hear this next item. But today, the Federal Communications Commission proposed fining the country's biggest cell phone companies, that'd be AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, and T-Mobile, for selling customers real-time location data. Real-time data. Really valuable stuff, right? Aggregate fine amount, $200 million. Which sounds like a lot, isn't, as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
Median household income in the U.S. is a little more than $63,000 a year. So when people hear about fines in the hundreds of millions...
You know, look, $200 million is a lot to you, it's a lot to me, but it's nothing to AT&T.
Siva Vaidyanathan is a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia.
It's the kind of fine it'll take them days or weeks to make back in profits.
So if these fines are just a drop in the bucket to these huge companies, why does the FCC do anything at all? Vaidyanathan says the agency has to enforce the law.
But the FCC gets to have it both ways here. It gets to appear like it is taking some action against a company that has flouted its authority. At the same time, it manages not to hurt these companies in any serious way.
Location data from your cell phone is valuable because it's basically always available and includes almost every American with a cell phone. Democratic FCC Commissioner Jessica Rosenworcel admits her agency didn't do enough.
We got to make sure these fines are large enough to be a deterrence. The digital world brings all sorts of possibilities for commercial surveillance. And in this case, they were violating the law.
She says the FCC kept consumers in the dark for nearly 2 years after the agency learned that wireless carriers were still selling location data. And also,
these fines are not as big as they need to be, and we took too long to do this. So I would say it's a day late and a dollar short.
The companies can argue that they aren't liable or should pay less. It's ultimately up to the Justice Department to collect any penalties. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
That exact tone that's really loving, but also kind of snarky.
Apparently that's what y'all want out of your astrology apps. But first, let's do the numbers. You know, it technically is the mixed music, isn't it? Holy cow, that one got away from me. Dow Industrial's off 357 today, 1.3%, finished at 25,409. The NASDAQ gained less than a point. I would have called it flat, but okay. 85.67, hence the mixed music. The S&P 500 down 24.8%, 29.54 there. Sean McHenry gets me on a technicality. For the week, the worst for the market since 2008. The Dow lost 12.3%. The NASDAQ declined 10.5%. S&P 500 dropped 11.4%. Caterpillar, a bellwether for the global economy, was in negative territory most of the day, but wound up 0.7%. Deere, John Deere, 2.1% to the downside. Industrial equipment company Cummins, powered down 2% today. Bonds, just because we mentioned them, the prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note, officially 1.16% where it closed. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, it's Molly Wood. So, over the past couple weeks, I was freaking out and then not freaking out and then freaking out all over again about coronavirus. And I'm sure you've been on the same roller coaster. So, for this week's episode of Make Me Smart, we asked an expert to make us smart about the real economic risks and consequences of COVID-19.
The idea is not to scramble at the last minute, but to anticipate the impacts. You know, tourism industry and all the hospitality industry are going to be first and hardest hit. And then the impacts ripple through the economy to other sectors, of course. There's going to be an impoverishing impact on small business.
Make Me Smart is the podcast where Kai Ryssdal and I talk about tech, the economy, and culture. And this week, everything we're doing right and wrong preparing for the next pandemic. Subscribe to Make Me Smart wherever you listen to podcasts.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We are going to do one more thing from our series, The United States of Work. Now, the first part of which we officially wrap up today. More from the 10 people and the 10 jobs we have been profiling as I get out of the studio to visit them all over the next couple of months. But in this studio right now, for a little peek behind the curtain of how we came to these 10 people and the jobs they have, our methodology, really, in other words, are the brains of the operation, producers Bridget Bodner and Maria Hollenhorst. Welcome to this side of the Soundproof class.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks.
So, Maria, let me start with you, since you did a lot of the actual data crunching on this one. 164 million people. We got it down to 10. What was Was there like a defining thing that you went into this and said, okay, here's how we're going to figure this out?
I mean, when you go from 164 million to 10, that is a challenge because there are obviously a lot more than 10 types of jobs and a lot more than 10 types of human. So we had to look at sort of that 10% level, like big zoomed out, what are the things that this data can actually tell us that we can create rules for and just stick to? One of the choices that we made was focusing on, you know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has all of these ways of looking at the labor force and all these different ways that they can cut
slice
them up
and dice,
slice and dice them.
Yeah.
And one of the big choices that we made was choosing to focus on occupation rather than industry.
So explain, what does that mean?
Right. So an occupation is the job that you do. The industry that you're in is the company that you do it for. So, for example, if you are a lawyer, you, that is your occupation. If you're a lawyer in a food and beverage company, food and beverage is your industry. We really wanted to focus on, like, what are people doing? You know, that lawyer, his experiences are probably going to be more similar to that of other lawyers than that of other people in the food and beverage industry.
Okay. So then to the thing that we've been talking about all week, these categories that we broke them down into, right? And I'm going to pick the biggest one, 4 out of 10 people. So we had our CPA, our doctor, our theater manager, and who else? Derek Lindstrom from yesterday, the education guy. That is the category of what? Remind me.
Management, professional, and related occupations. Right. And so that is huge.
Right. So we did that. That's 4 out of 10. And we had 2 out of 10 service workers, right? Okay. Bridget, how did we find these actual people, right? We got these archetypes, and you were very conscious of breaking them down by gender and geography and age and all of these things. And then we had to get on the phone.
Yeah. So we sort of had this idea that we were had this sort of puzzle matrix. Like, for example, we knew that like half of the participants would be women and half would be men. And then we knew sort of vaguely what their jobs would be and the sort of types of jobs. And then we just basically look until we find them. And so that involves cold calling, calling trade groups or like work associations, worker associations, unions, things like that.
Churches, so community
churches,
groups.
Community centers, senior citizen centers.
The most surprising thing out of all this stuff, and you have been working on this project for a year, Bridget Bonner.
Yeah. The most surprising thing is the disconnect, the incongruity between the number of people who, according to the BLS, have a second job and the number of people who seem to have a second job in both our mindsets and our...
And in real life. Right?
Yeah. And also when we were actually looking for people to talk to, how many people were disqualified. Because according to the BLS, 5.1% of
It's 5.1.
People in the labor force actually have a second job. Whereas we would sort of run into this thing where we'd find someone, they're great. Oh, and they also run this like landscaping business on the side. Yeah. So that means that they have a second job.
Maria, biggest surprise for you?
Yeah. I mean, truly, one of the biggest surprises for me was how difficult to find people that sort of match the characteristics of what we were looking for, but also just that there are 164 million people in this labor force, and we talked to a bunch of them. Every one of them has a story, and we just happened to choose these 10.
Bridget Bonner and Maria Hollenhorst, the brains of our series, The United States at Work. Thanks a lot, you two. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Guy.
I'm a Libra. Make of that what you will. Millions and millions of people make a whole lot of astrology, and some are making money off it. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at what's written in the stars for the astrology business.
Camille Eroy Revellis doesn't take astrology too seriously. Well, until Mercury goes into retrograde. It happens 3 or 4 times a year, and astrologers say it throws the world into total chaos.
Knowing that, I'm like, okay, this week I need to try to get as much done with my business as I can before that.
Eroy Revellis owns a personal training business in New York. She's 39 and a Capricorn. She pays $20 a month for Sirius Joy, a service that emails her daily horoscopes and weekly videos, kind of like a psychic weather report.
Looking at your 5-day mood cast, the week is very mellow except for Tuesday. That's the day where conscious storms may stir things up.
Eroy Revellis got into astrology a few years ago when she says work and technology and politics felt overwhelming. She says horoscopes give her the guidance others may get from church.
Astrology gives you a structure for understanding, you know, yourself. you're trying to make sense of a world that may be challenging.
Pew Research shows millennials are less religious than other age groups, but 60% of them believe in New Age spirituality. And these days, they don't have to flip to the back of a magazine to find their horoscope. There are more than 200 astrology apps in the App Store, which claim to do everything from tell you if your date is a love match to show you what you and your date's baby would look like.
The question isn't whether astrology is real or not, it's whether the effects are real or not.
Banu Gular is a Scorpio and the founder of CoStar, an app that has 7.5 million users and has launched a zillion memes.
We designed the app and the content all around how we actually talk with each other and really try hard to nail that exact tone that's really loving, but also kind of snarky.
And also kind of mean. The other day, CoStar told me I keep falling in love with the wrong people. It literally said, no false hope. No excuses, no tears. And that message is personal. CoStar uses NASA data to plot your birth chart, a map of the solar system from when you were born. Then comes the secret sauce. An algorithm spits out your horoscope. And it's that algorithm that's helped CoStar pull in $6 million in venture capital funding. The company isn't profitable yet, but Gular believes it can make money from extra features. Right now, the app has one for $3 that lets you compare your horoscope to your grandma's or even your dog's.
The industry has changed tremendously in the last 15 years.
Rebecca Gordon is a Virgo and an astrologer in New York. She's been doing a lot of corporate events for companies like Chanel, Simon & Schuster, and Adobe. I meet her in her Manhattan apartment. The walls are wrapped with shelves of astrology books. She plugs my birth info into a program on her computer.
Are you ready to see your chart?
I guess so. I'm a little nervous.
This is a snapshot of the sky at the exact moment you were born.
It looks like a pie chart sprinkled with the zodiac signs. But what can it reveal?
It would seem to me that you very much came here to impregnate consciousness with new ideas and to share ideas with the world.
Well, she does know I'm a journalist. I was hoping for something a little more crystal ball-like, but there were no predictions about my future. She says that's not the point.
What astrology will do is it will bring perspective and reframe a situation. It can change the way we see ourselves and the way we act in the future.
The price of perspective, in this case, $250 an hour. I'm Kristen Schwab, an Aquarius for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, more fun with ticker symbols. Video conferencing is probably going to be big the next couple of months as we all recalibrate to the coronavirus. So video conferencing company stocks would seem to be a good bet. No, especially the darling of the moment, Zoom Video Communications, Inc. And in fact, ticker symbol ZOOM is indeed up 513% year to date. The only problem is that ZOOM is the ticker symbol for a mostly out-of-business telecommunications company called Zoom Technologies that has not even reported earnings since 2011. The ticker you want, should you be shopping for video conferencing companies in which to invest, ZM, up a completely respectable 56% so far this year. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's down 357 today, 1.3%. NASDAQ gained less than a point, hence the mixed music earlier, which caught me by surprise, basically flat. S&P 500 down 24 points, 0.8%. Terrible, terrible week, as you know. Our theme music was composed by BJ Liederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.